Okay, so I edit a journal, hyperrise.net, and first of all, I'd like to do a really shameless pitch, which is if you have really great pieces that you think are worthy of public exposition, then send them to me or go to hyperrise.net and contact me in some way so we can show some of these pieces. What I'm interested in is how much work we do as artists that just never get seen ever. And Alan is a classic example. I think Alan's thrown away more good work than has ever seen the light of day. So
More than Tolstoy.
So Alan, send me some more work, please. Okay, so that's my pitch. And what can I do next? Let's see if this will work. Bear with me for a moment. Yeah. I don't actually know how to run this slideshow, I have to say.
That's frustrating.
That is really frustrating. Okay. Let's try it this way. Okay, here we go. Okay, so first of all, I wanted to talk to you about the incredible neurosis that comes with trying to produce a net art journal. And so I came up with this great little quote from the intro to Kittler's gramophone film Typewriter. It's the ground zero of hermeneutically inclined theorizing. On the one hand, a body in all its vulnerable nakedness. On the other hand, media technologies and all their mindless impartiality. And between them, nothing but the exchange of noise that only a certain amount of focused delusion, that's me, can arrange into deeper meanings. So I'm interested in, this workshop is about the creative process, but I wanted to focus on what to do with this stuff once.
Hermeneutically inclined,
looking for clues, I guess would be the best way to talk about it, just looking for clues in a text. So I thought I'd bookend this talk with this statement and also another one about neurosis at the other end. We'll get to that one. I'm going to start out by enumerating a few of those focused delusions that I see in my work as an editor. And Marjorie this morning pulled out this fabulous quote about editing being an afterthought in the creative process, and we all laughed. So I'm hoping that's a good starting point for the paper. Since what I want to do is talk about the intellectual work of the editor, and what I'm really interested in is how machinic the process of electronic editorship and electronic critique could be, not just in terms of kind of the instrumentals of making a journal, but also in terms of what we could use the computer to do that would be new as an editor. Okay, so let's talk about the machine editor. Most editing is quite like some old print editing processes, and I'm specifically thinking of homiletics, which is the study of the analysis, classification, preparation, composition, and delivery of sermons. And note how this has to do with the sacredness of the text in some sense. And it's true that much of what an editor does is what Nick's just called refactoring and compression. Great way to think about it. And there's also a lot of synthesis work to be done. In any editorial process, the editor is tasked with selecting and making a kind of a remix of the works in a way that makes sense as an issue, if you like. Then I have to write the introduction and somehow pull all these disparate pieces together. And I'll come back to this remixing task later, but first of all, I want to talk about the everyday practices of the editor. And I'll start with the idea of the editor as a kind of a machine. How much of what I do is fairly mechanical in nature? And there are three questions I have to ask myself, and that's: how do I deal with the review process, how do I deal with attribution, and how do I decide what to archive, how do I do it, which we've talked about a lot so far. So firstly, the review process itself, and this one's really quite easy to routinize and mechanize with tools like eJournal, which I think Laurie recommended to me, maybe. So I'm not going to really talk about that very much because it's really a very systematic process that doesn't need me except insofar as I have to email people. But secondly, there's a big problem with attribution in media work. One of the issues with archiving, and Ted Nelson has pointed this out, is attribution. But it's not just attribution of content, there's also attribution of form to consider. What software packages or languages did the artist use? And Alan pointed this out yesterday when we use code, modules, etc. from the web. We don't usually attribute that except maybe in the comments. And the problem with citation or even transclusion is that it's really designed for attribution of content rather than the form of a media composition. And so I think one solution to this is to look back at an old print tradition called the colophon. And why is it a colophon and not attribution? Because it's more like, in some ways, the assembly of a book, the font designer, the printing process. And what I'm trying to get at is the movement from creative attribution to the role of the machine as well in the creation of a piece. In other words, this is the tool I used as well as this is the intellectual trajectory I followed. And surprisingly, it's actually very hard to get some artists to volunteer this information, what tools they used, which you wouldn't think was the case. What I'd really like to see is for every person to write a colophon for their work, and even better, provide downloads of the source code if it was possible to have the source code available. That would be great for remixing. And some kind of colophon is crucial because one of the open questions would be what happens if the code is the intellectual trajectory that we're talking about. Wouldn't it be nice to see underneath what was there at any one time? And I hope that's what we're groping towards in this workshop. Okay, so thirdly, archiving. There's a really strong movement in ELET right now for acid-free bits. There's a recognition that electronic works, which are ephemeral in nature, need to be preserved in some way. Two suggestions from acid-free bits are, I love this one, preserve working antique platforms with each work. And in fact, I think last year at the ELO conference, there was a raffle that gave away a complete, was it a Lisa?
No.
No? Or is it was an LC system, I think, with all its software and all its hardware. The
classic Mac.
The classic Mac, yeah. And second, to try and convert the works into a standards-compliant, future-proofed format insofar as we can. Okay. But William Gibson really messed with our notions of preservation when he put together Agrippa, the book that destroyed itself. So I thought I'd talk briefly about intentionally ephemeral media works. And there's something really attractive about the ephemeral, instantly erasing work. Maybe it's because it takes us back nostalgically to the time before writing, a kind of oral performance. Two examples of this, Marcel O'Gorman's Dreadmill. If you haven't seen this one, he's actually on a treadmill and he does Lacanian theorizing while he's on the treadmill, talking about bodies, etc. It's a really great piece. And Dini Gregar's work in When Ghosts Will Die and Rhapsody Room, which are both, I think, based on virtual DJ, they're motion tracking dance performances and poetry, building poetry through dance. And because each one is a performance, the work kind of disappears as it's going. So it's more like the performance, the oral tradition, a kind of a runtime piece in the same time that a lot of electronic pieces are runtime pieces. They're one-off performances. So this is not to say that you might end up losing these ephemeral works. Of the recommendations in acid-free bits, it's the lowest tech, most enduring one that takes my fancy, and that's Matt Kirschenbaum's notation that Agrippa, even though you can't actually open up a copy of Agrippa and look at it, so many people have written down the text of Agrippa and spread it through the internet that you can go and read it in various places. So it's a way of preserving by almost changing the media form, spreading it out. And there's surprisingly little variance in the copies that are preserved too. So Matt calls it a complex network of individuals, communities, ideologies, markets, technologies, and motives, kind of a crowdsourcing model of preservation. Okay, so now I want to talk about the machine critic. And I was really struck by what Andy said yesterday about the distinction between expression and function being almost impossible to sustain. Although an editor functions as a refactory, as you like, she's also having to conduct a work of critique in order to figure out what's worth passing on for review. What is critique? Most immediately, it's a way of identifying patterns, a visualizing of important images, and then an uncovering discovery of meaning. And I'll come back to that last one later. The first two are probably parts of the process we could maybe automate in some sense, given the right set of technologies and knowledge bases. I'd like to see that. That'd be interesting. But once we've automated the process of identification and recognition, we need to get onto actually commenting on the work. So I've dredged up some more print words, which I'm sure I won't really do justice to, but here goes. First, there's postil or postilla, which is a medieval Latin term for a marginal note or a biblical commentary affixed to a text. And this is an operation you can see worked out variously with transclusion, with forms of tagging and notation, like Mark Marino's Marginalia project. And it's fairly straightforward because it seeks to explain rather than to interpret. And then the next step is to move on to more critique.
Transclusion is about the same thing. You don't want to make that a marginal comment.
Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, yeah. Yep. Okay, I've got another two old words, exegesis and eisegesis. Exegesis can mean explanation, but as a technical term, it means to draw out the meaning of a specific text, whereas eisegesis is to read one's own interpretation into the text. Exegesis is a way of attempting to view the text objectively. Eisegesis is subject. These are the jobs of the human critics, the undoing, uncovering, and maybe even vandalism or destruction of cultural materials. What I suspect is maybe we could automate the first one, but maybe not the second one.
What is the difference?
Getting out and putting in.
Yes, but very often. So what one person's interpretation of getting out, someone else would say, you're putting it in.
Well, if you could actually literally write it in, that would be my sense. If maybe you took a piece and remixed it, that would be a way of writing in a new meaning, or even elucidating an existing meaning in a new way. Yeah. Okay, so what's the point of doing all this explaining and analysis? And I'd say it's to reveal something, to see what happens when we rip off the scab. Criticism does this explicitly through analysis. Creative writing does it implicitly through stagings of formula and meaning. The machine can be thought of as a kind of a combination ripping and suturing tool. So I thought I'd be a traditional critic for a moment and ask whether a machine could be taught to do it. And Sandy, I'm picking on you. This is a piece called Goo from Hyperrise 2, one of my favorite pieces. And when I received this piece, it's actually a QuickTime video. No, that's fine.
Do you want the lights down?
Yeah, maybe. I think it'll be okay. The one of the points of Goo is that it's about a genocide that happened in, was it Indonesia? Or
Indonesia.
Okay, so I'm working with this piece and I'm discovering that in order to preserve the layers, because it's all in layers, if I want to resize it, I've got to resize every individual layer for some reason. So I'm going through. Yeah. Well, no, this is what I love about... I love this about Sandy's piece because I can do the next thing, which is first I take away all the soundtracks because I know I don't have to resize them. And then I go, well, I don't... Well, I can resize the text. That's really easy. And then I start resizing the video and I take everything away. And bam, what's on the bottom? This lovely skull, right? So there's death underneath there all the way. And this is one of my favorite pieces, I think, because of that. And it reminds me of Hans Holbein's The Ambassador, right? And you can see there's a skull kind of there, but you can only see it if you turn side on to the actual picture. And so it's kind of the same with Sandy's piece, which is you have to turn off all those layers in order to see the death that's underneath. Okay. And it's kind of fitting that there would be death at the bottom of this piece, not just thematically, but because that's the ultimate fate of a multimedia project, right? It's already doomed through obsolescence, if nothing else. Sorry, Sandy. Okay, so... Okay, so... maybe we could mechanize this little piece of analysis if we could get the machine to go through and pick out the individual layers and maybe say, well, okay, here's a layer with a skull on it. But for me, it's John Cayley's question yesterday, does this speak to the heart and mind? A machine critic will automatically read all those QuickTime layers and recognize them as individual layers, but would the machine be able to pull out and recognize that one layer, recognize the heart and mind, the poignancy or the abjectness of the death signifier? This is kind of the difference between sight and recognition that we were talking about yesterday. So the question is machine criticism even something we should attempt? Should we be trying to squash electronic works into a print-based model of presentation, analysis, or even preservation? Or should we try and do something different with the machines, make a new mashed-up genre that archives pieces and recontextualizes them? What I'd like to do, ideally, and I'm hoping someone can help me with this, is to go back to the kind of the Homeric oral tradition of recombining elements from multiple sources. In other words, chop up different pieces of media until they float around, stick them back together in unexpected ways, and come up with a new mashup every time the screen loads of all these different pieces. You could call this kind of recombinant or runtime archiving. And it would be a bit like the machine in orbit in William Gibson's Count Zero, if you remember that one, the machine with a lot of arms that goes out, picks out random pieces of garbage, and then puts them together to make these beautiful, inhumanly human, heartbreaking works of art. So what I'd like to do is to try and get an excerpting system going at Hyperize on the front page. There's basic problems with such an exercise. How do we capture flash, audio, video, the interactive, PHP? There was a piece in the last issue that's actually Firefox plugins. How do you excerpt something like that? And it seems like we'd have to convert every sample to one format. So we'd have to follow Rita's quote of Matthew Fuller, standardization is preconditioned for transmutability, changing from one state to another. And my question is, would this be scholarship? Would it be creativity? Would it be tool creation and coding? Or would the machine be doing the whole purpose of critique and archiving? I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, I want the machine to be able to try a mashing up and representing of the works, particularly if there's an element of randomness in it. But on the other hand, I can see how there would be apprehension about what this means for the role of the critic as we've imagined it. If a machine could learn to pick out the unconscious of the text, then I won't have a job, and maybe some of us won't have a job. So I'm going to end here with a final quote to express that apprehension, which I don't really share because I like the idea of machines doing something without me there. This is the ultimate horror, not the ghost in the machine, but the machine in the ghost. There's no plotting agent behind it. The machine just runs by itself as a blind contingent device. Okay.